This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Bonnie North. Merriam-Webster defines ethics as a set of moral principles, a theory or system of moral values, and the principles of conduct that govern an individual or a group. Well, our next guest makes his living applying both of those definitions to such fields as bioethics, digital medicine, end-of-life issues, public health and research ethics, and health policy. Craig Klugman is a professor of bioethics and health humanities at the Department of Health Sciences at DePaul University in Chicago. He's also the author of more than 450 articles, book chapters, and blog posts on bioethics. Dr. Klugman was in Milwaukee last month to deliver the Medical College of Wisconsin's annual medical humanities lecture. We welcomed him into the studio then. Craig Klugman, it is such a pleasure to have you on Lake Effect. Thanks so much for coming in.
Well, thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
I want to start with the notion of ethics. Let's start big.
Okay.
How much time do you have, right?
I got all day.
Yeah, okay. Why is there such a focus, do you think, on ethics, particularly bioethics right now? What is driving the interest, public interest?
Well, I think life is changing so fast. I mean, if you think about artificial intelligence, if you think about we now can have babies that exist in bags, at least for lambs, we're working on that. And if you think about genetics, that now, you know, in your kitchen, you could actually manipulate genetics of a small organism. And things are happening such a rapid pace that the question becomes, should we be doing this? How we should be doing this? Should we be regulating it? Should we be allowing just anybody to do this or restricting it more? So we get these big stories like last year, the birth of the two girls who were in genetically engineered embryos, and we get end of life issues. And people have been struggling for the last 50 years about how to make sense of these rapid changes in technology and medicine, that we're left with this question of what should we do and what should we not do. And so bioethics has sort of arisen to have these public conversations, both on a professional level and on a community level.
It feels to me like ethics has lagged behind the technological advances. That, you know, it, as you say, it's moving so fast mm-hmm. that you just barely get your head around one thing and five others pop up.
I say that I spend most of my time as an academic just keeping up with the news, trying to know what's going on and happening. Yes. So if we think about the technology happens, and what we try to do in ethics is react to that as well as anticipate it, right? So we want to get to the point where we've created frameworks and structures that exist, and we can think about these new adaptations happening. But we also are in the situation of we're much faster than anything they can do in law or regulation. So if the technology is happening at light speed, the ethics is happening at the speed of sound, and regulation is kind of the turtle bringing up the rear.
I was going to say geological time.
Yeah, basically glacial sorts
yeah.
of things.
Is there any movement to actually bring ethicists on board with technology teams?
There's a little bit. So there's some of us who do consultations. I was working for a few years with a pharmaceutical company that was doing a high-tech intervention. And so they brought on a team of ethicists to sort of figure out, what are the issues? What do we need to be concerned about? And they changed things based on what we suggested. They changed their consent process. We had a social justice concern about who would have access to these technologies. And so they actually went out and made sure that people could have access to it, which required going to the FDA and having them change some of their rules. And it took years, but it happened. But as far as, like, you know, artificial intelligence and cars, they're looking at less working with people in ethics. Google famously put together an ethics group to deal with its AI program. And that group lasted less than a week before they were disbanded, in part because they weren't using so much professional ethicists as people who were politically good for their bottom line.
Or motivated in a different way.
Yeah, I'm trying to be polite here.
Yes.
But they, you know, there was so much outrage over some of the people they were having on their committee that they actually disbanded it within a week. So it has not been as much as we'd like to see, as much as the thoughtfulness. You know, we get wrapped up with this new technology and the excitement of it and the things we can do and the lives we can change that sometimes we just need to breathe and take a pause. And I think that's what we do in ethics, is we create a sacred space where we can have these conversations as communities, as individuals, in the hospital, outside the hospital, in the state house, in the corporate boardrooms, to ask, you know, what direction should we be going?
But I'll bet that there's a certain amount of people accusing you of being wet blankets.
So there are people who have written and saying that we exist to prevent technology from moving forward, that we exist to stop research. And the reality is, we're not. That good ethics makes for good research. Good ethical thought leads to better technologies that, you know, help improve lives rather than just being focused on improving the bottom line. So for example, a lot of people are concerned when they have to go through a human subjects review board that this is preventing them from doing their work. But the reality is, the most basic part of that is, are you doing good science? Like, we shouldn't be wasting the time and energy of bringing in research subjects and exposing them to potential harms if there's nothing good that will come out of it. And so we actually force you to make sure you're doing good science. That's primary.
And we also don't want a repeat of Tuskegee or any of those other kinds of things that have been proven to not only be bad science, but really horrific to the participants who didn't know what they were getting into.
Exactly. We want to make sure that there's transparency and honesty, and that people are doing science that benefits society as well as doesn't harm people, you know, just because they're members of a group or, you know, there's lots of research that could be done if we didn't care what happened to the subjects. And, you know, we have Tuskegee, we have the Nazi era, we have the radiation experiments, we have the Guatemala syphilis studies. I mean, we're finding things all the time, unfortunately. But we want to make sure that we do stuff that is good for people and good for technology and good for society overall.
You talked about having something that we get excited about and we're not thinking through all of the implications. And of course, the first thing that comes to my mind is 23andMe, Ancestry.com. Not that they're bad. It's true. That we don't know what's being done with that information. It's really cool to know that, you know, you have family members over in some place you had no idea. And all of the shows that come up, you know, that people are saying, finding out about their ancestry, finding out all of these things. We love that. As humans, we want that story. But how do we regulate that? How do we apply ethics to that so that whatever we find out isn't used against us?
Well, there hasn't been regulation of this space. Remember that 23andMe was founded by the wife of one of the Google founders. So these are not companies that really are in the business of finding out who your family members are or finding out what diseases you might have. They're in the business of collecting data. You know, we are the product. We are not the customer. The customer are researchers and governments and data banks. That's who they're going after. We just provide the content for them, and we're paying for that right to do it. There's challenges that come with this, with having your information out there. I mean, we do have a law called GINA, the Genetic Information Non-Disclosure Act, which protects you from having your genetic information used in employment or health insurance. But that doesn't apply to long-term care insurance. It doesn't apply to life insurance. It doesn't apply to whether you get a job in the first place necessarily, or where you live, whether you have access to different types of assistive devices or can get different types of support from the government. It actually is a pretty weak law. So these things can be used against us in the future. And it's not just us, because when you provide that DNA sample, you're actually connecting 300 of your closest relatives. This has come up a lot recently in cases like the Golden State Killer, where now we have law enforcement wanting to use these databases, and they're really great databases to catch killers. And they're people who do not exist in the federal database for criminals, right? So those tend to be people who are people of color because they're more likely to get involved with and to get arrested and get convicted in the system. And so people who were more white, who were not in the federal databases, now we're able to find the connections that they committed these crimes. But we're actually not looking for them. We're looking for their families. So, you know, Golden State Killer was founded, somebody found a third cousin and then was able to reconstruct the family tree. If you look at the terms of use for Ancestry and 23andMe, none of them guarantee you privacy. They do have privacy statements, but It's that they will, you know, strip away your name if they use things. But your DNA is an identifier by itself. And there have been a lot of studies that come out of MIT's done quite a few of them that show it is pretty easy to re-identify de-identified data. So if my third cousin, who I don't even know, puts their stuff in, people can find out information about me, even though I've never done it. I've told my immediate family never to do it.
I have never done it, even though I am tempted, because it would be fun to find that stuff
absolutely.
Out. Absolutely.
Yeah. Absolutely. And, you know, day one of my intro to bioethics class, I tell students we'll do our genetics chapter, but before we get there, don't do these. Don't buy it for a gift for someone. Because if you read those terms again, it says for entertainment purposes only. So even
so, that's how they get around the ethical issues.
Right. They also had been giving some health advice for a while. The FDA called them out on that. And now they have to submit for each disease that they're better indicators. But there's so many things we don't know about the whole DNA area. I mean, there's no regulation on the laboratories. You give three laboratories the same sample, they're going to give you three different things because they're looking for different markers. They have different databases to compare to. There are cases of people finding out that they are one ethnicity or from one particular geographic region. And then a few years later, they're given an update and they're a totally different ethnicity because the database has expanded during that time. So this is not as certain. It's not like watching CSI and it's, you know, we always get our person. It changes as we learn more information and because there's no standard for how the labs run.
So how do you, as a professional ethicist and somebody who's trying very hard to get people to understand the ripples of all of this, how do you get them to do that? How do you say, hey, look, this is what you're doing. This is what you're giving away when you sign up for one of these things.
So in part, we do public conversations. Like I'm here to give the 14th Annual Medical Humanities Lecture at MCW. So we bring the public in to talk about these things. We teach in our classroom. We write op-eds. We write blogs. We actually talk to our legislators and try and get them on board and understand what's happening. We try to get people engaged to know that this is happening and to try and get their elected officials and their family not to do it and to think about what regulations we need and what laws we want to pass.
Even though those will be slow in getting passed.
It'll be very slow, but you know, this is a long-term project. This is the future of humanity. So we're not about the short-term getting an answer today. We want to lay out good frameworks and good structures for tomorrow.
One of the other things that you do that I have to say I found really fascinating is your art rounds. And this we're kind of shifting gears here away. Well, ethics still play a part in this, but I love the idea of visual literacy.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm hoping you can tell us a little more about what you mean by that and why it's important for health professionals in particular to have it.
So we live in a very visual culture, right? We've with the rise of cell phones and emojis, language is, you know, the textual language is becoming less and less of what we do and so much more of the visual, you know, Netflixing and, you know, watching TV and graphic imagery. So we have to understand what these images are and what they mean and where they come from. And so the idea of visual literacy, especially in medicine, is that a lot of medicine is just looking at people. You know, you come up with a differential diagnosis based on their symptoms, but sometimes just looking at a person, you can see what fits, what doesn't fit. And as a patient, to be seen is a really profound experience. It creates a connection to your healthcare provider. There is a sense of a placebo effect, just being seen and heard and witnessed. And so what we've been doing with art is trying to increase visual literacy and visual observation skills through the use of museum art. And that's the Art Rounds program. And so we take medical students and nursing students and we make them work together because even though we train them separately, when they're in the clinic, they work in teams together. So we make them work together and we teach them a process called VTS, Visual Thinking Strategies, which is actually used for little kids to teach them how to engage in art. And it's three simple questions. What do you see? What do you see that makes you think that? What more do you see? And we do this over and over. And we'll look at a single piece of art for a half hour. Now, the average person in a museum looks at a piece of art for 8 seconds.
I was going to say 2 minutes. I was being generous.
Yeah, no, yeah. 8 seconds. Yeah. There's been studies on this. And so to have to look at a piece for that long, you really begin to see things. And this is a skill that you can develop so that the next time Maybe you don't need to spend 30 minutes looking. One of the things we did in art rounds was, how do you take looking at a piece of art and then bring that to the clinic when you're looking at a patient? So we got models, and we put models in the galleries. And on the very last session, we do multiple sessions, we have the students look at the models as if they are a piece of art, and they're describing things. And for the models, when you ask them what this experience was like, they felt very exposed, because they're, every flaw is being pointed out, every little mark, every, you know, one nostril's higher than the other, just things that most of us would never realize or ignore or want to know about. We've done some pre and post review of this assessment and found that actually having them make the transition to the patient, a model from the piece of art, gives them that transference ability. And, you know, the patients feel more seen, more witnessed, more observed. And in the long run, this can save money in the healthcare system, because you don't necessarily have to rely on the high technology if you can just spend time looking and seeing, oh, they have this mark, they don't have this thing that's often common in this case.
It sounds like it's an offshoot of the standardized patient, the idea of a real person coming in and you having to do a differential diagnosis as a medical student. You know?
And actually, we started it through the standardized patient program.
Oh, did
program.
You? Okay, yeah. So that makes sense, because it sounds like it would be something that would help that.
I mean, there's kind of an irony in this, isn't that part of the whole work of the medical humanities is helping healthcare providers see patients as people with their full rich stories and histories and experiences. And yet we're putting people in a gallery and saying, look at them as objects. So there's a little piece of this that bothers me that we're doing it, but we also let the students know that, you know, this is not how you address a patient where you just stare at them for a half hour and point out all their flaws, that this is just a tool that they're learning along the way.
It helps them see better. That's the idea.
It does. Yeah. And, you know, we spend so little time looking at things anymore. You know, 8 seconds in a museum where you're going a place to look. But, you know, when you're scrolling through your feeds on your phone, when you're driving, things barely enter your consciousness anymore. And we're just trying to say, slow down, take a moment, just look. And you will be much more effective as a healer, and your patients will feel much more appreciated.
What would you say to the patients? What's the reverse? Do they need to be paying attention in the same way?
Well, you know, one of my projects with the medical humanities is that it's not just for healthcare providers, that it's for everybody, because we are all either future patients or future lay caregivers. And yes, you should be paying attention to what your doctor does. Are they looking at you? Do they make eye contact? Or are they just staring into a computer screen the whole time, which many healthcare systems actually encourage? And to ask for what you need. I need you to look at me when I say this. You know, I want you to see this rash I have. There's something unusual about it. You need to ask for what you want and need as a patient, because it's not necessarily there anymore, because we've become such a corporatized system of healthcare.
Right, which is one of the big complaints. You're just a number.
Sometimes you feel that way. Very often you feel that way.
Right. Which is what you're hoping to move people away.
We are. We're trying to take doctors and medical students who are trained to take standardized tests, and that there are right and wrong answers. And by injecting the humanities into their training, we're teaching them there's no right answer. There's no right way to interpret a piece of art. There's no right answer to what this, you know, misty thing is in the background. There's what you see. So we get them comfortable with ambiguity, which is something we do not teach in med school, where it's all there is a right answer and there's a wrong answer.
That, in science, ambiguity is a difficult thing. Yeah.
Yes. And science itself is what we read in a journal article is the outcome of interpretation of data and observation. And, you know, all of this, the subjectivity of science and medicine is something that we don't talk about that often, which is why the humanities approaches is so important for people who are professionally going to be doing this, to understand that, you know, a data point is not necessarily just a number. There's a story behind it, and what it means depends on the context in which it exists.
And that's where the ethics come in, too.
And then you round back to ethics.
Exactly. Yes. Well, Craig Klugman, it has been such a pleasure. I have enjoyed this thoroughly. Thank you.
Well, thank you for having me.
Craig Klugman is a professor of bioethics and health humanities at the Department of Health Sciences at DePaul University in Chicago. He's also the co-director of the university's minor in bioethics and society. Klugman was in Milwaukee last month to deliver the medical humanities lecture at the Medical College of Wisconsin. We spoke with him then. You can learn more about Professor Klugman's work at wuwm.com.